This is a fascinating story we're about to tell you about. October 28th, 2015, a boat meant for only a few dozen passengers capsized off the coast of Greece. Hundreds of refugees forced in desperation onto the overloaded boat manned by armed smugglers were tossed into the sea. The resulting loss of life, the largest in a single day during the crisis in the Aegean, shocked the world. After nearly a decade of research, interviews, and investigation, reporter Gene Carstensen has looked to capture every detail of the 24-hour drama that unfolded. Her new book is A Greek Tragedy, One Day, A Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. It is a great pleasure to welcome Gene Carstensen to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Your name really isn't that hard to say. I don't know why I'm making such a big deal of it. Good morning. How are you?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. You know, I read this book and I was really fascinated by it, and I'm mad at myself because I don't remember much of this, maybe a brief moment, but not remember this horrible thing happening not that long ago in 2015. Have you encountered that a lot?
Yes. You know, it's a decade later. I think what people do remember, though, is 2015. That's when a million people were crossing from Turkey to Greece. And certainly people remember some of the horrible shipwrecks. Also, you know, what people remember is that photo of that one child, Ilan Kurdi. I don't know if you remember that. It was a photo of a little
boy.
So everybody remembers that. And then when they get into the book, the whole thing starts to come back, and, you know, my incident sort of brings it alive for people. My book brings it alive for people.
That idea of one day and how much happened in that 24-hour period of time, give the audience a sense. You've been really with this project for a long time.
Yes, I worked on this, well, almost a decade in a way. It began when I was a reporter over there for The World, the radio show, and Foreign Policy and some other outlets. So I was there with hundreds of other journalists, and I saw this shipwreck that day. It was horrifying, and I reported on it. But, you know, years later, I was thinking, I was still haunted by it. You know, you're so close to something like that. And I saw people's faces on Lesbos in the port town where the rescuers brought the survivors. You knew they'd been through hell out there, but I thought, what really happened? You know, why were they traveling? What was it like for them? And I also wanted to know, what was it like for the locals and the rescuers? So about 4 years after the shipwreck, I began the process of going back and researching and doing many, many interviews in order to kind of reconstruct that day.
One of the things that you say is that you felt that you were part of the tragedy because you were so close to it. How difficult did that make your job of unwinding all of the various threads that had been balled together?
Well, I think, you know, as a reporter, when you're close to something like that, it does impact you. And as I started interviewing people, you know, I found a loan officer from Kabul. He was only 24 at the time, and he survived the shipwreck, but not all of his family did. And I interviewed him twice. I flew to Turkey, where he ended up after the shipwreck. And the stories just got deep inside me because people were very open and very brave to tell me about the terrible loss, you know, that they went through. So it is challenging, but it's also, you feel like you have a chance to be a witness and maybe bring that to, you know, other readers who just wouldn't have any idea what people went through.
The idea of the elements of it, and you were having trouble even discussing some elements of it as you were working through it, because there is so much that is disturbing about it. As you were looking at it and wanting to tell the entire story, where did you want to begin? What did you find to be the proper moment to begin?
Well, I ended up beginning the book. The prologue of the book is with a Greek fisherman who I knew. And one thing about this crisis is the authorities, the Coast Guard, the European Union, they really hadn't put enough rescuers out there. And so the day of the shipwreck, it was really the local fishermen and fishermen from Turkey that joined with the Coast Guard, and also some Spanish lifeguards that were out there. So I wanted to start the book with this Greek fisherman, and he was out fishing for calamari late at night, and it's the night before this shipwreck is going to happen. And he gets a call on his cell phone from the Coast Guard, and it's like 2 a.m, and they say, "Hey, Kostas, something's going on out there. Can you go check out this incident?" And this isn't the big shipwreck. This is a smaller incident, but still horrible. A rubber raft had sunk out in the middle of the channel, filled with families. And so he took his fishing boat close, and he could hear them crying. And just all out there by himself, he rescued all of these people and brought them safely to shore. And I wanted to start the book that way because I wanted to give an example of a lot of simple, helpful things that people did during that period that they never got any credit for. You know, there's a lot of good, kind behavior that goes on that we just don't see. And in part, this is because the media, we tend to focus on how many people died and sort of the worst side of the story. But there's also quiet, beautiful acts that I uncovered and write about in this book.
It is stunning because you obviously want to look and remember and think of those who lost their life. But in that month alone, in that October of that year, 10 years ago, as you mentioned, it's like 130,000 refugees came to the island of Lesbos. I mean, it is incredible. And over the course of the year, almost 1 million people crossed from Turkey to Lesbos. That is an insane number by any measure.
It is an insane number. And yes, 130,000 in just 1 month. The population of the entire island of Lesbos is 85,000. Another way to look at it is, you know, they were arriving to the north shore of Lesbos, which is, you know, right across from Turkey. Right. They are only small villages and towns along there, which one has only 150 people. And then just 2 or 3 boats would arrive, and that would bring more people than the population of their entire village. And just a small correction is to Lesbos, around 500,000 people arrived, and then the rest of the people arrived to other Greek islands along there. But it was a lot of people, a stunning number. But that's why I decided to write about one day, because the numbers just start to blur after a while.
The numbers start to blur, but you were able to extract names and people and stories from that bring it to such life and horror. I'm curious as what it was about some of the individual stories that you chose that struck you, of what it was about their stories that said, okay, this is important to put into the context of this tragedy.
Yes, it was just important for me to understand why people had left their home and why they had risked their lives and gotten on this boat. So one person I found, his name is Hidayat, and he's a loan officer from Kabul.
Yeah.
And he was only 24 at the time. And so I found him. I also found a young artist from Syria. She was living in Istanbul, and she had had to flee Syria because of the civil war. And all the details started to build up in me, and they became very important. Like the guy from Kabul, he told me that his two young sons, they were traveling with a computer tablet that they had to share between them, and their favorite game was Candy Crush. And those little details just make it come alive for me. And it was very sad for those kids when their tablet was lost. It was stolen by some smugglers along the way. And so by the time I write about them getting on the boat, you kind of have a sense of who they are as people. And then when the boat goes down, you're really worried what's going to happen to Hidayat and his sons. What's going to happen to this young artist?
Just looking at Hidayat for a moment, this is, as you say, worked in a bank and ultimately targeted by the gangs because working in a loan department there, made the determination that he could not keep his family safe in Afghanistan, which is why he decided to make the journey. And I mean, that sets it up, doesn't it? As the point that things were so bad that you take this tremendous risk.
Exactly. And this is something, as a reporter, and when I talked to many people who were traveling during that time, they all had different specific reasons, but none of them wanted to leave their homes. It's just, if I were to think right now that I had to leave my home within a week and flee to another country, it would be incredibly upsetting. And so it was for them as well. But if you want to take care of your family and keep people safe, you do what you have to do. And, you know, there's tremendous corruption in Afghanistan. And at this time, this was before the Taliban came back, but it was still very, very dangerous. And there were still suicide bombings around. But he still wanted to stay because they felt at home there. But once this happened with the gangs and they were threatening his wife and his kids, his wife was pregnant, there was just no way that he felt he could stay.
The other thing, too, is that these are professional people. Most of these, in looking at, yes, Hidayat and being in that loan officer or a psychologist or the young woman you mentioned that wanted to be an artist, these were professional people who had the means to make that trip.
Indeed. And, you know, a lot of people who do arrive to different countries are not the poorest people. They're often middle class people. And that was the case in 2015 during that big mass migration that happened largely because of the Syrian civil war, but also out of Afghanistan and other places. Yes, they were middle class people, could be a farmer, it could be a policeman, it could be an artist, a journalist. I mean, I just met people from all walks of life. And so, yeah, in my book, for instance, the Syrian psychologist, an amazing guy, Okba, and everybody remembers him because he weighed 470 pounds, very, very large guy, trained as a psychologist, and he was trying to open a preschool in Syria when the civil war broke out in 2011. He loved Syria. He was the youngest of 10 children, very, very happy in Syria, except for, you know, the repression of Assad. But he was able to live there and stay there until the civil war exploded and there was just no way to stay safe. And that's why we saw millions and millions of people coming out of Syria at that time.
You also, of course, talk about those who helped in the rescue efforts. And as you make this point that some people certainly helped more than others, but this was, as you say, overall, a decent response, a decent response of people who, I mean, it went on and it wasn't tenable, but the response that came immediately was what you would hope it to be, right?
Yes, it really was. And I used to think that as I was there reporting and watching, I was thinking, gosh, if I had to go through something like this, I would rather arrive in a place like Lesbos than some other places where there wouldn't be kind people there handing out water and sort of doing their best to take care of you. The day of the shipwreck, it was really awful because there you saw that the local population was being pushed beyond what they could really respond to. It was a terrible, terrible sight for the people in this small town of Molivos. It's a port town, and the Coast Guard and the fishermen and the lifeguards were bringing back the rescued people to this town. And, you know, it's population 2,000. All they have is a little clinic. They don't really have any facilities there. And suddenly their entire port, which is normally for tourism or for fishing, there are hundreds of people there. There are medics trying to save the lives of hypothermic children. And the people, villagers ran down, and international volunteers who were on the island, everybody came to the rescue, but everyone knew it wasn't a professional rescue the way they wished it had been. One story, incredible story, a cafe owner, his name is Theo, one of the owners of a popular restaurant there, he just rushed out to see what could he do. And all of a sudden, a medic just took this little three-year-old girl who was almost dead from hypothermia, put her into his arms and said, please keep her warm. And so this guy just ran to his car, kept the girl in his lap and turned on the heater and held her for an hour or so until an ambulance could come. It's that kind of small gesture, an attempt to help, that I found very, very moving.
And in some cases, you talk about these two jet skis and of people who are helping, lifeguards who are helping, and they're looking at those, they're looking for children specifically because they're so vulnerable. They were so vulnerable in this case and during these passages.
Yes. So that day there were a group of Spanish lifeguards on the island, and they had two jet skis, and they drove several miles out to the center of the channel. And these four men on two jet skis were the closest to hundreds of people in the water. And so they are the ones who pulled the people from the water and then put them on their jet ski and took them to a fishing boat or to the Coast Guard. So they were very close, and they had hundreds of people around them who needed help. And when I interviewed them years later, these guys were, tears came out of their eyes for how difficult this was for them, because they had to sort of choose who to save. All these people are calling out, save us, save us. And so what they did kind of on instinct was go for the children. There were many, many children on this boat. And sometimes even if there were adults and children together, they would just take the children and as quickly as possible get them to a Coast Guard, and then the Coast Guard would take the children to shore. And as I did interviews over the years, I found that all over the island, without having any coordinated policy. That's how people responded. And I think there's just some kind of gut instinct. If there's no professional rescue operation going on, let's just do what, follow our human instinct. Let's save the children.
That human instinct in general is, and you make this point in the book that you, that there are those of us who have this choice of are we going to work and turns toward this problem and help, or are we going to turn away? And that's the aspect of the story that's so relevant to what we're going through even today. And I think many of us realize that it's all too easy to turn away, even though we are aware of the suffering that's taking place.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any automatic reaction that people always turn towards or turn away from a problem like this. But I do see that people who decided to help years later, I think that they feel good about their efforts. And I think that we all feel good if we may not be able to help all the time. But when we completely turn away and just ignore a problem, or if, migrants are out of sight, out of mind, then we don't really know what they're going through as human beings. And I think that it's important that there are points of contact, between people who are on the move, migrants, and local populations, because there's a lot of small points of contact that we may find that we have more in common than we really realize. But we won't know that unless we have a chance to actually meet the people.
The name of your book, A Greek Tragedy, One Day, a deadly Shipwreck and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. You certainly look at it in the book, the human cost of the refugee crisis, but it is yet just a snapshot that we have yet really to get an entire picture of what that crisis means short term, long term, and what we learn from that tragedy that day that can prevent it from happening in the future.
Yes, it's hard to prevent it from happening in the future. These things are going on all the time. Migration has been part of the human experience, and it continues to be so. And, forced migration is on the rise, and there's a lot of conflict about it. But what I took away from writing the book is realizing that this could happen to any of us. It could happen around climate change or fire. It could happen around conflict. Most people, where conflict comes up and wars break out, they don't necessarily think that that was going to happen to them and that they would be refugees. So for me, that's what I took away, is that in a way, to be a citizen of this world these days, it's good to be prepared for this and to see migration and struggle at the borders of being something that we all have to contend with.
And in your telling of this story, it is these volunteers and the islanders who were there to help, even as the government was failing to act.
Yes, yes. Ideally, when you have a mass migration like that, the governments that were in charge, and that would be the Greek government, the Coast Guard there, and the European Union, and their border control, which is called Frontex, they were there every day, and they rescued many people, but really their main goal was to patrol and to try and keep people out. But they also had the obligation to save lives. And so what happened in the absence of sufficient response by the government is that civil society, the local population, stepped in. And if it hadn't been for the Coast Guard, for the local people. And also there were thousands of international volunteers who had flocked to Lesbos at the time. Many, many more people would have drowned that day, and many more people would have drowned over the course of that year. So it was an amazing, amazing response of especially the local people.
Gina, thank you so much for this incredible work and for sharing the story with us. Gene Carstensen is the author of A Greek Tragedy, One Day, A Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. The book is published by Atria. Gene, thank you so much for being with us. A pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. Fantastic conversation. Thank you.
Be well. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.